Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bound. Today, I'm joined down the line by Charlotte Burns, US News Market and Business Editor at the Art Newspaper, who has the lowdown on this year's International Contemporary Art Fair, Frieze New York. We'll be discussing the galleries, those record-breaking auctions, and all the fun of the fair. That's in inverted commas, we'll see. Over the next 15 minutes here on the Arts Review on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show, Charlotte. I suppose your time, it's kind of tiring, right? It's been a long week. Have you chosen the right footwear?
I never choose the right footwear because I'm quite short.
You love the heels.
And so I need the heels because I'm 5'1". I can't see anything otherwise. So no, sore feet.
Sore feet. And presumably a head full and an Instagram account full of amazing things that you've seen. We're going to tackle the fair first, and then we're going to talk about those crazy auctions, those amazing big number auctions that we talked about in the introduction there. But first of all, does Frieze New York feel part of New York City this time around? I think in its third incarnation?
No, it still doesn't, because it's on an island, so it's quite hard to get to still. So there's either a sense of adventure or a sense of time suck, depending on your frame of mind going into it. It's, you know, the great thing about the fair is that it's so large and spacious, and once you're there, you're kind of there. That's also probably the downside, that once you're there, it's quite hard to leave.
Yeah, I like the idea of time suck. You kind of have to decide when you're going to be there and spend the day there, don't you?
Yeah, and it's kind of an unusual choice for a fair, because usually, you know, fairs are sort of embedded in places near pretty good transport links. And obviously it's quite hard to set up a fair of that size in New York, you know, on Manhattan itself. So it's just adjacent to the island, the mini island is adjacent to the bigger island, but it does take a while, you know, to get there if the traffic's bad. And so a lot of collectors go and, you know, may not necessarily go back. So that's something I think the fair probably needs to work out logistically, like means of improving the speed. You know, if everyone's leaving at the same time, you have, you know, thousands of people sort of pouring out.
And does that affect the kind of splash that the fair has to make? If collectors are going to kind of come for one time only during their trip to New York, or you know, coming from their Upper East Side apartment or whatever it might be to get down to Randall's Island for the fair, do you think that affects the way that people do the booths, that they have to make a bit more of a statement?
Well, the booths are very big. I think they're some of the largest booths in most art fairs. So the art tends to look good. It's sort of massive. There's a sense of being in like an airport terminal where there's no real sense of time and everything's quite white and bright because it's a tent. So I think the dealers definitely try to do that. You know, they always try and put their best foot forward with these things. There's a lot of colorful painting. You know, they kind of need, you always need something to anchor the booth. You know, that's the kind of way you think about it. So you have to have either a you know, great big sculpture or some big display. And some of the things that work best or were most spoken about this week were some of those kind of more unusual presentations, because they can grab your attention a little bit more. So Gavin Brown, who's a New York gallerist, always does something interesting at art fairs. And this year he had, it was one of the most popular booths, an artist called Jonathan Horowitz had a work called 700 Dots. So on the first day, Gavin was, I think, the only dealer to have completely empty walls, because his project was participatory and people were paid $20 a piece and they sat at these, you know, one of several tables and painted black 8-inch dots on white square canvases. And then they were hung up throughout the fair, and then that was the wall. The finished painting was hung in grids and created a sort of, you know, minimalist mural of all the fairgoers' attempts to create uniform dots.
And that's an amazing, a very confident booth to put up, right? To sort of say, well, this is our artist and you can deal with him on a very personal level and you can see some of your own work up on the wall. That's a presumably a great show, a great imaginative show and a great show of confidence from Gavin Brown.
Yeah, he's good at creating kind of conversation starters. You know, it's a kind of booth. I mean, we saw, you know, celebrities were all sort of standing there. Leonardo's standing there chatting to Gavin. And Gavin had also bought some works, but he had some kind of suite of works on an outside wall of his booth by Joan Jonas, who's representing America in the US pavilion at the Venice Biennale right now. So he did have stuff elsewhere. So I think it was more to kind of draw people in and have something to talk about. And then you can, hopefully, if you're a dealer, take that conversation onto a deal.
Yeah, exactly.
Elsewhere.
It's got to start, exactly. It all leads somewhere, despite how it might start off.
Free dinner.
No, exactly. Now, we obviously know that you, Charlotte, have a very busy week as one of the editors at the art newspaper. You do the daily newspaper from the major art fairs, Frieze New York being no exception. And those papers tend to have an angle each day. What were you looking out for this year? What was the thing that you noticed, whether it was a style of work, whether it was photography, whether it was big canvases, bright colours? What were the stories that you were covering this week?
I was writing actually about artists moving galleries. It's a side effect really of the market right now, which is very strong, especially for a lot of artists. You know, it's conceivably a good career nowadays to be an artist if you're successful, and I think that's a big shift in mentality. And so the relationship between an artist and their dealer has quite traditionally been like a marriage, a monogamous relationship that hopefully lasts a long time. The idea being that the dealer...
I like that you defined marriage for us there as well.
Well, you know, there's different kinds of marriage,
right? I was
going to
say, some people have a shifting definition of that as well.
Yeah, exactly. I thought it was best to sort of, you know, go back to the
lay down the
ground
rules.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not exclusive.
Charlotte, you're a good Irish girl.
Oh, my dad will be pleased to hear that.
Sorry, I stopped you in mid-flow there.
So a lot of artists now, the successful artists are moving, and, you know, Mark Bradford, Sterling Ruby, Amgrina Dragset, Adela Decimed, Cecily Brown, Adrian Genny, Theaster Gates, these are all just a few of the artists who are shifting allegiances. And we kind of figured it was a side effect of an art market in which, you know, nobody batted an eyelid at the fact that, you know, more than $1.5 billion was going to be spent on post-war and contemporary art at auctions this week. So dealers, you know, some dealers are trying to pin artists down into exclusive relationships because, especially if that artist has large production costs and they want to be able to kind of reap back the benefits of their investment. Other artists are sort of leaving to pursue more polyamorous relationships where they work with, you know, 7 different galleries and don't promise anything to anyone. So it's kind of interesting to see who's moving where, because it's all really about the shift in power, and the artists are in the driving seat in some of those relationships. If you're one of those kind of, you know, sought after artists, you don't have to work with someone, you know, and even younger artists are sort of bypassing that traditional model to find funding in other forms, because the art world's grown so much. You know, there's so many more art fairs, there's so many more private foundations, museums have expanded, and so there's more places to show art, which means there's more art needed, and so some artists can kind of bypass that traditional relationship.
I suppose it's
altogether
a supply and demand thing at the moment, and we're seeing things change, like they changed the music industry, something we never perhaps thought we'd see in the art world. One thing on that, Charlotte, do we see more artists at the fairs because of this relationship? Are they out and about more visibly at the fairs, events at which they often shy away from because of the commercial aspect of them?
Yeah, I think this thing of, you know, artists not being commercial is sort of shifting, because, you know, some artists, I remember sitting on a plane on the way to Basel one year next to the artist Ryan Gander, who said, you know, don't tell anyone, but I love art fairs. So yeah. I see all my mates, there's parties, like you see loads of other art, and I know I meant to hate it, but it's quite fun. And I get out of the studio for a week and kind of catch up with everyone because everyone's here. So that networking aspect's, you know, something that a lot of artists shied away from discussing openly. And there's definitely still a generation of artists who wouldn't be seen dead at an art fair. But even artists like Chuck Close, he goes to art fairs and then says he sort of has a morbid fascination. It's sort of like, you know, a cow visiting, you know, an abattoir, he said.
Except the cow at the end of the day, gets paid in steak. Which is exactly. It's a strange thing.
Worse for the cow.
Worse for the cow. I know. Well, that was Frieze New York, and we're going to turn to the auctions now, which are obviously an integral part of it, or the other way around. In fact, I suppose Frieze New York picked up on the success of the auctions. It's big auction week, or it was in New York, and I expect all of our listeners will have seen all the zeros on the ends of these figures attached to these auctions. What was the atmosphere like in New York during auction week, Charlotte?
Well, I think everyone was pretty exhausted by the end of it. There were more sales than ever. And usually there's a fortnight. The first fortnight is the Impressionist and Modern section, and Christie's and Sotheby's each hold, you know, their day sales and the big evening sales. And then the following week is the post-war and contemporary, and there's usually three auctions: Sotheby's, Christie's, Phillips. This year there was one auction, Sotheby's Impressionist and Modern, in the first week. Christie's held three auctions in the second week, as opposed to the traditional one evening sale. And so it made for a very packed agenda, with five auctions over four nights. So by the end of it, people look like they're about to slide off their chairs.
And Christie's holding three auctions in one week. This is sort of far bit for me to say greedy, but that's a sort of huge amount of work. Was all of it of kind of blue chip quality?
Well, the interesting thing about these sales was how much of the work was guaranteed to sell before you even walked into the auction room. And so I think on the first evening, the Monday night sale, I think something like 69% of the works were guaranteed to sell before you walked into the auction, which is a huge amount. Yeah, 69%. And then on the, and that's for 35 works. And then on their Wednesday evening sale, they had a bumper 82 lot sale, and 61% of that, I think, was guaranteed. So that's kind of interesting, because you're walking in and there's a private deal that's already happened, and then that will play out. And Phillips had a pretty similar strategy. Last night, their sale, I think the most overused term by the auctioneer was, and this goes to the absentee bidder, which was often the guarantor. So in effect, that was a private sale that just, you know, sort of was watched by people in a big room.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing. What does that do? I mean, as a reporter on these things, Charlotte, you perhaps are inured to the excitement of it, but there's always occasionally a round of applause, and certainly some sort of hushed whispering and an excited atmosphere in the room during these things. But this really relies on works going under the hammer, literally. How does it work for the atmosphere in the room, the theatre of the auction, when these things are already sort of pre-guaranteed?
I think, well, you know the art crowd anyway is a pretty tough crowd to please. They're not usually very giddy. And I think going into it, not everyone understands guarantees, for starters. I think it's confusing kind of business getting tool, because the houses have different policies and different ways of remunerating the people taking the risk. I think that in the trade, people are, you know, somewhat leery of the guarantees. But I think in the room, you know, when you're watching a Picasso sell for, you know, the world's most expensive object, it was the, you know, Femme d'Alger was being sold on Monday evening. And the previous record was set a couple of auction seasons ago for a Francis Bacon triptych. And that sold for 142.4 million, I think. This Picasso was guaranteed at 140 million. So going into the sale, you knew that this was probably going to be a world record. It was set up to be a world record. It was, you know, a great work as well, really gorgeous Picasso. And so you knew that you were probably going to be watching auction history. And that's exactly what happened. You know, there was a lot of bidding for the work. It was very popular. You know, the price was climbing up in these unbelievable numbers where the auctioneer is sort of going 140, 142, 145, and you're thinking, million.
Just like
right.
That, yeah.
Yeah, and so, it climbs up, and then all of a sudden, you know, at the end of that, everyone applauds, because, you know, it's sort of exciting to see that, also a little bit obscene to see that. I think there's a lot of emotion going into these things that people can't quite believe it. And a dealer said to me as they left the sale on Wednesday, you know, we have to be careful not to think that this is normal, because everybody's so used to this now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Charlotte, the zero key on your keyboard must be broken by now, I should imagine, writing about these deals and these auctions. And just in terms of the social side and in terms of the art quality side, who won last week? Was it the galleries under the tent at Frieze New York, or was it the auction houses?
They're such different markets. It's sort of like, you know, comparing children. You know, you can't really do that publicly, I suppose.
We're back to good Catholicism here, aren't we? I like it. Sorry, how we always end up.
Sticking with a family metaphor.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. It's sort of like, you know, the younger art at Frieze, overall the art at Frieze is younger. There's definitely a move in the market to blue chip work. And on the primary market, which is the, you know, typically the gallery stuff at Frieze, There's a move to, you know, blue chip artists, like these kind of artists who are moving around. You know, they're very sought after. The emerging market's doing pretty well. I think the mood was good. You know, in New York, the Whitney just opened. People are in an art mood. And but if you're going to go for quality, you know, for masterpieces, I mean, it's going to be the auctions, because it's sort of like an art history lesson. You know, yeah. These great Mondrians and Picassos that you sort of see and you're like, wow, great. You know, it's a gorgeous work of art that you don't see usually outside of a museum. So you'd have to go there, really.
You'd have to go there. Well, for the time being, Charlotte Burns from the Art Newspaper, thank you so much for your words of wisdom on New York's Spring Art Week. You've been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher. My researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again tomorrow when we'll be getting to grips with this year's Eurovision contenders, no less. Until then, from me, Robert Bound, thanks for tuning in.